the screen here of the traveling of the on the second journey, and the white line is kind of their traveling out away from Antioch, and then the red line represents their traveling back toward. Actually, they go back through Caesarea, Jerusalem, then up to Antioch. If we look at this map, this region up in here of Antioch, of Pisidia, of Iconium, Lystra, and Derbe are places that Paul has preached before on the first journey. And now Barnabas and John Mark are down here at Cyprus on this second trip. Before they had left by boat from Seleucia down to Cyprus, and then from Cyprus up to Perga up here, or to actually Attala, and then to Perga. This time they're going to be walking. And from Antioch all the way up here to Troas is probably 700-800 miles. So you're going to see this is going to be a trip that's going to take a few days. And it's going to be somewhat of a difficult trip in that. It, just geography, the Taurus Mountains, which is a very large mountain range, runs along this area, and they're going to have to pass through the Seleucian Gates, which is a gap in the mountain range, and it's the only way that you can feasibly cross the mountain range if you're going from Taurus over to Derbe, and they're going to have to cross through that. And at the times, it was a difficult and a dangerous trip. So just keep that in mind. As much of Paul's travel was in remote areas to get from city to city, and so when we later see, he talks about he encountered dangers. We can imagine just the kind of dangers he did encounter. Now we got to the 16th chapter. He ends up coming back and up here to Derbe and then Lystra. It doesn't really say much about Derbe, the things he does there. As a matter of fact, it doesn't say much about what he did in these churches that they'd been through before, except that they came back to encourage the disciples, and they were delivering the decrees which they had received from the apostles and elders in Jerusalem. And so that's mostly what they were doing. It talks about the churches were strengthened in faith and were increasing in number daily. So the gospel was increasing in this area where Paul had been before, Derbe, Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch, and they were delivering the letters. One thing that on this trip that was going to become significant for Paul and his travel is here at Lystra. He meets a young man named Timothy. He's a son of a Jewish woman and a Greek father. Timothy is a person that Paul wants to take on the trip. He sees that he's a dedicated person, one who would be of value for him on the trip. He takes the young man and circumcises him. So that when they go into the synagogue, that he'll be able to take him into the synagogues and not offend the Jews as he takes him into the synagogue with him. Because Paul, as his habit is, he tries to go into the synagogues if there's one in the town. And so he circumcises Timothy and takes him on his trip. Of course, we know from the rest of the New Testament, Timothy becomes a very significant teacher and one who is a great aid to Paul. But he does meet him here in Lystra on this trip and takes him with him. After they leave Antioch, it seems like it's, if you look at our map here, you can see it's quite a ways from Antioch all the way over to Troas, where the next real action is going to take place in the book of Acts. And Paul is forbidden by the Spirit to stop in Asia and gospel, and he's forbidden to go up in Bithynia. So he's forbidden to turn left or right on the road from Antioch all the way to Troas. And if you can imagine that, Paul is marching here some 350 miles and not stopping in any major cities to preach the gospel. So I don't know how many days it would have taken him But I think that you can see that he's probably, as well as he likes to stop and teach, he's probably getting anxious time. He gets to Troas and really begins to wonder what the Spirit has in mind for him, because the Spirit will not allow him to stop in these areas and to preach. Of course, when he gets to Troas, we have this vision that he has, and he sees a man that is over in Macedonia, which is from Troas. It's across the sea, and Macedonia is the kind of the northern part of Greece, and major cities there are Philippi, Thessalonica, and Berea. And so he sees the vision of the man in Philippi or in Macedonia, calling him to come over and preach the gospel to them. And so immediately they look for a ship, and they find a ship, and as it says, they sail. And it seems it's in just a very short order, which may be 2 or 3 days from Troas to Philippi, and that's probably 150 to 200 miles. And so if you could walk, rather than if you could sail that in a couple, 3 days, if he were to walk around, it would take him 2 or 3 weeks to walk around the land to get there. So I'm sure he was very anxious to get to Philippi and to preach there. One other interesting thing I want to note here, because this journey seems to be, the people who are with Paul seems to be varying somewhat regularly. We know he picks up Timothy at Lystra based on the phrasing in the text here in chapter 16 and verse 10. The writer of the book of Acts has been saying they did this and they did that, like in verse 8, and passing by Mysia, they came down to Troas. In verse 10, it says, and when he had seen the vision, immediately we sought to go to Macedonia. So there's another person joined their travel group here at Troas, and who is the writer of this. And we're fairly certain that would be Luke has joined them as they're going to travel here now with him from Troas up to Philippi. When they leave Philippi, it talks about we arriving in Philippi, but it doesn't talk about we leaving. They leave Philippi. So apparently Luke is going to travel along with from Troas up to Philippi at this time. It speaks of Philippi being a Roman colony. And I think that's going to be significant for us as we get into looking at the things that are going on. I want to mention that at this time, we learn from over in the 18th chapter, when Paul moves along on his journey and gets to Corinth, he meets Priscilla and Aquila, and they have been expelled from Rome because the Romans are having a problem with the Jews. Well, since Philippi is a Roman colony, I believe we're going to see from the things that go on here in this verse, or in this section, that the Jews are not in favor or in favor in Philippi. As a matter of fact, I think we're going to see that there probably are not too many Jews there anyway, because there does not seem to be a synagogue in Philippi. Because once they arrive in Philippi, it talks about down in verse 13, on the Sabbath day, they went outside the gate to a riverside. We were supposing there would be a place of prayer, and we sat down and began speaking to women who had assembled. This is one of the cities that Paul goes to that he does not mention, that he first goes to the synagogue to speak. But here he goes outside the city, and where he thinks he can find a group of people who are assembled for prayer. So he's expecting to find some God-fearing people, which would include Jews and some God-fearing Greeks or Gentiles out for assembly for prayer outside the city. And he gets there, and of course he does find a group of people that are assembled. He finds a group of people there. He speaks to them, but a certain woman named Lydia, and who we know is the seller of purple, mentions that she is a worshiper of God, and that she opened her heart and responded. She does. I think that if we see the writer of the book is consistent with that term, that means that she was a Greek person or a Gentile and not a Jew, because we see consistently through the book, the writer uses the term Jews and worshipers of God. When he uses worship of God, he refers to Gentiles that are have assembled with the Jews in studying the Old Testament scriptures. So Lydia is baptized, she and her household, and then she begs the Paul and his group to stay with her, and she makes it kind of a test of their confidence in her, because she says, "If you've judged me faithful to the Lord, come and stay in my house." And she prevailed upon them. So she's one of these good sisters that will not take no for an answer. And so it's interesting that even in a place that there are not a lot of Jews, and there's initially doesn't seem to be many opportunities, Paul is able to see an opportunity in Philippi here. And this woman, her household, hear the gospel. So I'm going to break it up there. We'll come back and talk about the other things that he mentions going forward. So we'll open that up for any comments anyone might want to make.
Dave, just one thought. Rita and I have had the good fortune to actually be in Neapolis, which today is called Kabbalah. And we took a bus from there to Philippi, and the bus was snaking up the side of the mountain. It's a very steep mountain, up from the seaport there up to Philippi, which is up somewhat in the mountains. And the bus was struggling to make it up this hill doing the snake. And yet we could look out the side of the window, and you can actually see the Ignatian Way, the ancient Roman highway that Paul would have used, and it went straight up the side of the mountain. So I was very impressed with the fact that Paul and Silas and Timothy and Luke were walking up this very steep mountain. It's about 25 miles from the seaport of Neapolis up to Philippi.
Okay. I appreciate that, Eddie. And if you look at the geography of all of this area of Seleucia with the Taurus Mountains and all the area around the Macedonia and Achaia and Greece, it's very rugged terrain. You've got some really high mountains that run all the way down to the sea. And any time that they're traveling by foot in this area, it's a rugged trip. And so it takes a It'd keep your weight off. Other thoughts? Okay. After Lydia and her household's converted, Paul and his companions apparently stay with her, and they're going about the city, the marketplace, trying to find people to study with. And apparently in verse 16, it happened as we were going to the place of prayer. This must be another day they're going back out to where they had studied with Lydia, looking for other people, and traveling out to study there. And we have this slave girl who has a spirit of divination. She has apparently she's inhabited with a spirit, an evil spirit, much like we see back in during the days of the Gospels and early in the New Testament. And because of that, she is able to tell fortunes or have some insight into the future. Now, that seems to be what is going on. Because she can do that, the her handlers are making money off of her, charging for her. It seems that Paul gets impatient with that, or he gets after an extended period of time, he wants to stop that. And Paul, she's going around saying these are servants of the Most High God. And this is, to me, is very much like a case with Jesus back in Mark, Mark the first chapter, when the Spirit was trying to announce who Jesus was, and Jesus stopped the Spirit. Here, Paul stops this evil spirit from witnessing who he is. And my perspective, part of that has to do that God does not need Satan to witness for him. And if Satan is going to try and witness for God, we know he's going to distort the truth, and that the truth will be turned into a deception or a lie. Well, Paul sends the Spirit out of this young lady rather than trying to use her as a witness for him. God witnesses that Paul is indeed his servant as he sends his Spirit out of her. Of course, the people who have the young lady for profit, they get upset. They've lost their income. They seize Paul and take him, Paul and Silas, and take him into the marketplace before the authorities. It was typical in a Roman marketplace or agora that they would have some sort of a judgment seat or a place where they brought people to settle differences. And apparently they drag Paul and Silas into this this seat. We're going to see some other cities that have something similar to this. And I think it's interesting the charges that they make against Paul and Silas is these men are throwing our city into confusion, being Jews. That I think suggests that indeed they're wanting to get anything they can to charge Paul and Silas so they can, get vengeance or retribution against them because they've lost their source of income. But they charge them being Jews and causing confusion. And also they say they're saying proclaiming custom is not lawful for us Romans to practice. So that's some of the things that makes me think that maybe this is related to the conflict, their concept, since these Jews have come to town, the Jews are not in favor with the Romans. This is a handy thing to grab onto to try and to get some vengeance brought out on these teachers of the gospel. And so they stir up a whole crowd against them. They inflict many blows upon them, have them thrown in prison. Jailer puts them very securely in the inner prison, locks them in the stocks. And then in verse 25, it says, but about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns of praise to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. And so we've got the town is in an uproar, beating up Paul and Silas. And they're sitting in a prison singing praise to God. And so not seeming to be upset, but thanking God for his protection. And then, of course, we have the earthquake. It shakes the foundation of this prison, opens all the prison doors, releases everybody's bonds. The jailer, of course, comes running in. And we know the Roman law. He assumes that all the prisoners have escaped. And he would not live the next day if they had, but Paul pleads with him not to harm himself, and we're all here. And then the jailer knows that there's something going on here that he needs to know about, and he makes this plea here in verse 30 after it. Him out, he said, sirs, what must I do to be saved? The jailer is one who one minute thought he was going to be have his life taken for losing his prisoners. The next minute he sees that everybody is there and something miraculous has occurred, and he realizes that he needs help. He's very much like the people back in Acts, the second chapter, when Peter preached that message about the fact they had crucified the Savior. And they said to Peter, "What can we do? We need some help here." And then Peter finishes the gospel to them, tells them to repent and be baptized. Well, Paul says this jailer here, "Believe in the Lord Jesus Christ." That's Paul's consistent message. He presents the gospel to him in verse 32, and he and his that same hour of the night, he and his household were baptized. He brought them out to his house, set food before them, and was sort of like Dempsey's lesson this morning. Here we have fellowship. They've come together now. Those whom he had been put in stocks and had been separated, they come together in fellowship as those who have become both in covenant relationship with God. And so after they have their meal the next day, the magistrates, it doesn't say why the magistrates changed their mind, but maybe overnight they realized that they didn't have anything against Paul and Silas worthy of holding them. They say, "Release them." Paul says, "No, wait a minute. We can't be released. They beat us as Romans unfairly. They need to come here and talk to us." And so they came and appealed to them that they would go out and not cause any trouble. I'm sure that these magistrates were concerned that they could be in severe trouble for beating Paul and Silas. And then they came out of their prison and went back to Lydia's house and encouraged the brethren and departed them. One of the things I'd like for us to, someone to comment on, why do you think Paul insisted that the magistrates come back themselves and personally release them from prison? So let's open it up for discussion on this section here of the slave girl who has is demon possessed, and also the events of the prison there. So,
I guess.
Go ahead. Did we lose audio?
He may be on the move there, so his phone might have cut out.
Okay.
I had always assumed that the reason. I assumed that reply was that the gospel would spread more due to the influence of the magistrates. Once it's widely known.
Did I break it?
It kind of broke up. You might be on the move there. I'm not sure.
Other thoughts on this whole section here of the demon-possessed girl and Paul's interaction with that?
This may be a secondary issue, but, you know, I continually look at this book and find kind of new things that I hadn't thought of before. So something you were saying earlier, you kind of keyed in on, you know, the fact that the accusers focused in on the fact that they were Jews. Now, I mean, certainly there's a religious aspect of that, yes, but there's also a national aspect of that as well. The way that they reply to this and other times when they are called Jews or troublemakers or things like that is not to lash out. you know, when if somebody came to us and said these are dumb Americans, you know, they're nationalists and they think they're better than everyone and they're trying to corrupt every other nation and try to teach them right. And they always think that they've got the right. You know, take that personally. And so then once that happens, the message gets lost. You know, you exactly what Jesus' nationality, it serves the purpose of kind of advancing the gospel. You know, that's the only time that Paul uses that in his letters. We have a tendency to get so offended sometimes, and then the whole point gets lost when we do. And they just stick straight to the gospel message and what's supposed to be taught. And I'm just continually, you know, impressed by that. Like I said, it's a secondary point, but I think it kind of bears notice.
You're saying they didn't get involved in politics?
Yes. Unless it served the purpose.
Right.
Dan, there's one thing that struck me about this. Paul's reaction to this girl, it says that he was greatly annoyed and at what she kept saying. And although the language is not used in exactly those words over it back in Acts chapter 13, it seems like he was annoyed with Elymas the magician also when he said that he would be struck blind. I don't know that I've got a point to make from that other than just to simply bring attention to it. But I found that interesting.
Well, I do think that both the Lord and back in the book of Mark and Paul here is not going to allow Satan to witness for him, for God. Now, I think that's significant. Okay, other thoughts there? Now, it does seem that everything's gone quiet. Is everybody turned off or just me talking?
I can hear you.
Okay. Thank you. Well, if no other comments, I'm going to go back to where we were and look at some more of our travels and things. So, Paul completes his stay here in Philippi and moves on to Thessalonica, and then he's going to end up in Berea in the 17th chapter. When he gets to Thessalonica, we immediately see that he finds a synagogue of Jews, so there must be a larger Jewish population in Thessalonica than in Philippi. Apparently, the Jews had a tradition that if there were 10 Jewish men in a community, they could form a synagogue. If there were not 10, they could not. So apparently there were not as many Jews. If we understand that to be a tradition that was being applied, there must have not been many Jews in Philippi as there are going to be in Thessalonica and in Berea. As he says, as his custom, he goes into the synagogue and he reasons for three Sabbaths. And I like what it says in verse 3, explaining and giving evidence that Christ had to suffer and raise again from the dead, saying, this Jesus I'm proclaiming to you is the Christ. And so he goes into the synagogue and he reasons from the Old Testament scriptures about Jesus being the Christ. Is how he preaches in a synagogue. It says in verse 2 that some of them were persuaded. A great along with a great multitude of God-fearing Greeks and a number of leading women. So some of the Jews in the synagogue were persuaded. We've got some God-fearing Greeks and leading women in the city who apparently have been coming to the synagogue or are being influenced by the people of the synagogue, learning about God, and they too now are turning to the Lord. As is standard in verse 5, the Jews become jealous. If there's one phrase you can see all through, even from Christ's ministry, all the way through the apostles' ministry, is that anytime the gospel is preached or the some success is shown with the gospel in Jewish communities, the Jews immediately, their leaders get jealous, whether it be the synagogue officials or it be the Sanhedrin or whatever. Jealousy seems to be the thing driving the Jews in their opposition to the gospel, because they're afraid that they're going to lose their place of prominence. It seems to be the thing, and someone else will get credit for teaching about God. They became jealous. They stirred up strife. And this time they're drugged before the authorities. And the charge that the Jews now make is a little different than the charge that the merchants back in Philippi had made. These Jews, they make the charge, they found Jason. They couldn't find the Paul and Barnabas or Paul and Silas. They've said that these men have come and upset the whole world, have come here and upset this community also. And they declare that they're trying to get us to act contrary to decrees of Caesar, saying there is another king, Jesus. So back in Philippi, the merchants had said they're trying to get us to practice customs which are contrary to us as Romans. Here they're saying they're trying to declare another king who is Jesus is king, which is a contrast to Caesar being king. So I think what we see is the Jews are trying to pick something they think the Romans will latch onto to bring vengeance upon or to persecute the apostles. They didn't find Paul and Silas, but they take a pledge from Jason. I think that's somewhat of an indication that the authorities were not as stirred up by this as they were by some other things, because the Jews were bringing these charges. Again, I think the Jews are somewhat out of favor. So they just secure a bond pledge from Jason, and he's not stirring up any trouble, and release Jason. And then Paul and Silas go on from there to Berea. They get to Berea. They go to the synagogue again, and they begin to reason from the scriptures in the synagogue at Berea. Many of the people in the synagogue there believe, along with a number of the prominent Greek men and women. So they're having very great success in teaching the gospel. It talks about, of course, our famous statement we're all familiar with. The people of Berea were more noble. They actually listened to what Paul and Silas had to say. They examined the scriptures to see if it was so. And that's why there seems to be a great number of those that responded to the gospel, much more so than was in Thessalonica. But the Jews of Thessalonica are not satisfied. They come along and stir up the people of Berea, and the brethren send Paul out to take him out to the sea, to send him on to Athens, which he's going to go to next. And Silas and Timothy stay there in Berea, encouraging the brethren, and Paul makes his way to Athens. So now we'll just stop for a few moments here and talk about any comments you have on the Thessalonica and Berea.
Okay. Dan, there's one thing that struck me there. The charge that was made that they're preaching another king other than Caesar. And that reminded me of Pilate at his trial with Jesus, the second or third trial. I don't remember now which one it was, where he said, are you a king? And Jesus says, yes, I am. Now, we emphasize the idea of the kingdom, not of this world, which certainly is very important to recognize. But I think maybe we also need to emphasize the kingship. Even though these people misunderstood Paul's preaching, they were getting the basic gist of it, that he was preaching about another king.
Yes.
And we need to recognize Christianity means we're serving under a king. And we should not downplay that or dismiss that in any way.
Well, I think you're right, Eddie. And that had to have been some element of Paul's preaching, that he is heir of the Davidic kingdom. He is God. Well, that's what Peter said on the day of Pentecost there. He's made him Lord and Christ. And so, yes, definitely, he is king. And I think that's a good point to be made. They picked up something out of his preaching that they tried to use that against the disciples in front of the Romans.
And he still sits on that throne today.
Right. Good thoughts. Other thoughts on their time in Berea and Thessalonica? Okay, we've got just a few minutes left. I do want to spend a little bit of time with Paul's sermon and on Mars Hill. And so we've only got a very few minutes left. So I'm going to opt to not go into his time in Athens. I think it's very interesting to look at what went on in Athens as Paul goes in there by himself. He's been run out of three cities in Macedonia. He's come to Athens, and I think it's going to be interesting that they're just pretty much nonchalant about what he has to say. They're curious, but they're not really emotional or motivated as a group of people about what he has to say. I want to we'll pick up there Wednesday night with his being in Athens.